Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lucas and Vincent were not in the mainstream of gay life.
I was saving body parts such as skulls.
Doesn't it bother you that he's a fag?
You have done me a great service. Now I must service you.
And the drugs were always a cry for attention, for somebody to pay attention to me before I, you know, kill somebody.
You can imagine what it smells like if you go into a closed room.
Something is trying to get inside my body.
Yeah, she's female and she's waiting for you in the cabana. And you want to sleep with me.
Buckle up, sodomites, and welcome to the Sinister Sissies podcast, your guide to true crime, horror, and everything man on man and macabre. I'm Jared, your master of depravity, staring at the beautiful face of my filthy little slave, Sam Hamilton, for the very last time.
My eyes are actually welling up. I feel sad. I can't believe it's over.
This is our last episode, everyone.
Cry because it's over, I'll tell myself.
He is willing.
Smile
up.
Because
awesome.
Smile because it happens. Big reading card. And it's sad. We've been doing this Jared's been doing this for four seasons.
Yeah, 3 years, four seasons. We've been doing it for what, 2 years?
Well, no, it's edging towards three. Yeah. We started doing it like January 2020 and now it's almost November 2023.
We got through a pandemic doing this podcast.
Shit.
Yeah, it's 2022.
Okay, so it's been, anyway, it's been years. It's
We've been
a long
old.
Time.
Yeah.
We are. I was only 27 when this began.
Oh, you were a youthful young boy.
Now I'm even more used up in the gay world than I was back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, gay death has taken hold at 30.
Yes. Well, it used to be 25. Now daddy culture's in, so it's okay to be old as long as you're muscly. So I need to get on some steroids, stat.
That's true. It's
Fuck.
True. So this is our very last episode. The topic for the episode is basically just something for us to rant about, I think.
Well, it was for Jared to intentionally rant about. And I will say I took some issue with this show. Well,
I feel like it's great because it shows that this podcast has converted Sam into being much more critical, I think.
I don't know, critical. I don't know if the people in this documentary series are qualified to be critical.
They are not. They are not. So we're talking about Queer for Fear, which is an exclusive documentary series on Shudder, created by Brian Fuller of Hannibal TV series.
Yeah.
What else has he done?
He did Pushing Daisies. People love that show.
Okay, yeah. And it is ostensibly meant to be a four-part series looking at LGBTQ themes. It's the first time I've ever said that on the podcast. In horror. Whether or not it achieves that, I reckon there is a huge question mark.
You could definitely play a drinking game, but you would be dead in about 5 minutes every time the word queer is said.
Oh yeah, they love the word queer.
Horror is interwoven with queerness.
Queer people are considered outside society, and horror is outside of society.
The werewolf is the perfect allegory for coming out of the closet.
Dracula's modus operandi appears to be to enslave women and torture men with a kind of psychosexual obsession.
Yes, master.
So many of us can relate to being the monster in the room.
There's a power in being a monster.
You begin with queer artists taking the spaces we're allowed to have, then slipping what we can say into those spaces.
We've been a part of the genre of horror since the beginning.
Come here.
They've done a great job at assembling anyone who is a relevant entertainer right now who is queer.
Relevant with question, you know.
Well, I knew almost everyone appearing, okay? So I'm going to say...
A lot of TV... But actors.
But are they qualified to be... I mean, I guess... I don't know. I guess... I think the problem is the show is presenting it as being a very cerebral take on horror films.
Which it
films.
Is not. And we're going to talk about some of the very glaring historical inaccuracies in this documentary series.
And I think that if they had just presented it as like a more of a like sitting on the couch, like what do you think?
Like an MTV, you know what I mean? Yes.
I think because it's presented as like almost like an academic sort of dissection... Yeah. But then you have just like random, like you have like Alaska Fun to Fuck and other people.
You have, this is someone that I don't even know if you would know who it is. You have Bruce Valanche. Bruce Valanche is known for being, I think, the middle square in Hollywood Squares, which was a popular show in the mid 1990s.
Well, look, they've got contemporary and somewhat contemporary people.
So I think. There's something nice about ending Sinister Sissies talking about this documentary series because it's demonstrating the very way of approaching horror that I hated, which is the reason that I started the podcast, right? So a lot of what you see in this documentary series is people looking at horror history or movies. And there's no actual like gay sex or trans stuff happening on screen at all. What they're doing is they're kind of reading in queer themes. And like there's reasons for that. There's like a whole academic specialty, which now has influenced popular culture. But I'm really, really against this idea of settling for this read into queer theme. And the example that I was going to give... to kind of indicate the thing that I really don't like, is you know how, like, this is about, like, 5 years ago now, you know how, like, everyone was talking about how Disney villains are queer-coded?
Yeah, isn't Scar gay?
Yeah, so shit like gay. So that is influenced by this way of thinking about media and media criticism that, you know, there's this hetero-patriarchal culture that is hiding... the hidden meaning, this hidden queer meaning in popular media. And so that queer-coded villains thing came about because of that. There's one aspect of that that I think is accurate. So like Ursula in Little Mermaid was based off of Divine. So that's a clear, like that's not a queer-coded anything. That's like a literal connection. But the common thing about queer-coded villains that we hear about, like Scar and Jafar... what they do is they say, well, their animator was a gay man, so clearly this must be a representation of homosexuality, or it must represent certain themes, and we can read that into it. Even though, I'm going to get his name, the animator of Jafar and Scar, Andreas Deja, has said on many, many occasions, no, what the fuck are you talking about? This is really offensive that you think I can only make gay characters. But there is this acceptance that no, it's perfectly fine because we can read this in. We can project our understanding of what it means to be gay or trans in the 21st century back into old media.
Which is kind of problematic in itself, really, because it's kind of associating perceived femininity from male-presenting characters or identifying characters as being... making them, it's an association with homosexuality. People can be, like you're watching, children's entertainment is often over the top because the point needs to be very clear so that the child will understand what is being sort of presented.
And you depict the villain as eccentric. And that is like, that through the history of storytelling, you make your villain eccentric. you make him like that. There's the people talk about like in the history of literature and stuff. They talk about like the trickster archetype. That's what that is. Like that is not anything that needs you to read anything into it. And what it leads to is some really shitty cultural takes, which I just threw out this fucking documentary series.
Well, I think a lot of the series is reaching, and there is kind of that one devil's advocate interviewee that I can't remember what his name is now, but he was like, what were they talking about again? I think they were talking about the Universal horror films, and there was like, you know, was this intended to be gay? I don't know. But
oh, I have that, a lot on that.
Can
yeah.
that be like a reading of this? Sure. But like, is it the intention? And I think that like, obviously as queer people, I'm saying the Q word, we are outside of society. We are, you know, deviating from cultural norms, etc. But that doesn't, does that mean that in every film where a character deviates from a cultural norm, that it's meant to be like, there's meant to be queer subtext? I'm not sure. And this film is definitely reaching at times. And by film, I mean documentary series. You know what I'm saying?
So like, well, I don't know. Are we outside of society now?
I think to an extent. I think we're like kind of like, you can be like an accessible gay where you don't talk about, like at work, for example, if I was like, oh my God, I went to like a bareback breeding orgy last week.
Yeah.
People would be like, what the, are you okay? Like, are you on drugs? I don't know. People, you know, that's not acceptable. That's sure. That's putting you outside. But if you're like, I'm, you know, if you're like, I'm gay and I like men, that's fine. But
yeah.
Like there are cultural aspects to the gay and queer communities that are shocking to like outsiders and that people wouldn't even know exist. So,
sure. I mean, in terms of, yeah, certain kinds of sexual behavior, totally agree. But I also think that like that particular way of viewing ourselves currently, that idea that like to like come out and all that sort of stuff, that's something that you can only really use as a model to understand very recent media, because that people would have that experience. Mm. One of the issues that this documentary does is that it tries to take a really contemporary experience and project it backwards.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
So like there's a really horrible bit. I think it's Emily St. James, who is a media critic. She's talking about The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And she makes this really just horribly inaccurate claim that The Picture of Dorian Gray is about what it's like being in the closet. And like, there are so many reasons why that makes no sense. Like, one, Oscar Wilde would not have viewed himself as like a gay man that he needed to disclose to the world. He described his tendency to fuck rent boys as a form of sexual madness that he needed to like discharge occasionally. It wasn't like a identity or a sense of self for him. And so it clearly, that's not going to be the themes of The Picture of Dorian Gray. The Picture of Dorian Gray has like homoerotic themes to it. Like the whole thing is about a really beautiful man.
I mean, I think the issue with a lot of this documentary and the reads that a lot of the participants are having on certain films is that they are kind of like dissecting the films, but they're kind of, what they're saying is kind of like, they're presenting it as fact.
Yeah.
When it's opinion based, but everyone's saying it with such certainty that it's,
they're so confident when they clearly don't understand the subject matter, and it's infuriating. And why aren't there like film scholars being interviewed?
I think that, well, there are like, this is the other problem, right? There are three or four really good film scholars that are, or at least people in the industry that have really relevant things to say.
Yeah.
But overall, I'd say there are about 25 to 30 participants.
And they're like, think of the amount of times that Alaska Thunderfuck speaks versus one of those academics. Like she does the, like quippy lines, and that's included much, much, much more.
Yes. I at least twice it was like Mary Shelley was like the original guff girl or like something like that.
Said, no, okay. So that also, so let's go to episode one. Episode one is all about Mary Shelley, Oscar Wilde, and Bram Stoker. Alaska Thunderfuck makes this claim that she's like, so there's all this stuff about, they talk about Mary Shelley being a feminist, which is not that inaccurate. Her mother was an incredibly famous second wave feminist, but Mary Shelley rebelled against her parents' views a little bit. Like the whole purpose of Frankenstein is not a gay allegory. It's an allegory about science and industrial progress and how that can get out of control and create kind of, you know, trying to control nature can create disastrous results.
Mm.
So in many ways, she was kind of rebelling against some of the progressive views of her parents, because she was a really nuanced person. But like, there's a really awful fucking line. This is from Tawny Cypress, who's an actress on Yellow Jackets, calls Mary Shelley a queer woman, asterisk on that for historical accuracy, and then says she was one of the original hags.
Well, isn't that because it's speculated that her husband was into men?
Yeah, this is fucking Percy Shelley. Percy Shelley was meant to be into Lord Byron, and the basis for that is that he wrote a very loving letter to Lord Byron. And this is the entire thread that they use. They use it for Bram Stoker as well. They look at what was quite normal friendship between men at that time, where you would express love and affection. And they're doing like the homophobic thing of being like, isn't that really fucking gay? Like, there is literally, so Bram Stoker, I don't know much about, but I know that Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, that is an entire fabrication. There is no evidence to suggest that. They were kind of free-wheeling sexual people. Like, the doctrine of free love comes from that romanticist movement of which Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley were part of, and they, like, fuck other people. But, yeah, there's no indications that they actually had sexual relationships with someone of the same sex at all.
Mm.
But everyone makes that claim, like, several times in this documentary.
Yeah, I always thought Mary Shelley was, you know, was into women. Or is it all speculation?
It's based on letters that she wrote to a female friend.
Okay.
And that's all we have. And so this, I don't know, this really, I don't know, even the idea of just calling Mary Shelley a queer woman to me seems really, really out of place. Like queer is meant to have that association of like, you know, transcending gender roles or transcending sexual boundaries or things like that. And look, yeah, she believed in free love for her time, but she was very much a woman of her time. She would not have, like, if you transported her today, she would not be like out in the clubs, gay clubbing. She was kind of conservative in many ways. Like, she didn't believe in radical revolution. She was in favor of kind of bourgeois reform for her day. It just, I don't know. That was the first bit that kind of triggered me in this fucking documentary.
I was watching it, trying to imagine Jared's reactions, which I found almost as entertaining as the actual documentary. So
like, okay, I'm going to keep ranting. The first episode is the worst one, and then I can like defer to you. Okay. So then they move on to Oscar Wilde. They already described that, like, the weird projections backwards of trying to make Oscar Wilde's life exactly like theirs. But they perpetuate all of the fucking classic myths and misconstruings of the Oscar Wilde trial, which so many people get wrong in popular culture. I don't know if you know this. Like, okay, wait, maybe I'll test this. If you were to describe Oscar Wilde's trial and conviction, what do you think happened? This is not meant to make you look bad, because I think you've just absorbed what the popular narrative.
According to this documentary, it was about him being gay.
Yeah, right? Like, and that they, you know, arrested him for being gay, and then he was thrown in prison for many, many years, and then he died in prison, right? Like, that's the kind of narrative.
Mm.
The actual narrative, much, much more complicated. Oscar Wilde is much more of a complicated figure. Wilde's lover had a father who wasn't happy that his son was fucking Oscar Wilde. And so his father wrote a letter, and on that letter called him a proposed sodomite or something like that in the letter. Oscar Wilde then sued that father in libel. He took that father to court, and then in that courtroom, the father, Oscar Wilde, was working under the assumption that all of the rent boys that he fucked were actually on his side and wouldn't self-incriminate themselves. But they were all very happy to, because, you know, I don't like when people do this either, but like, I'm sure 30-something Oscar Wilde fucking 16-year-old rent boys probably wasn't the most like mutually, Wilde always had in his head that it was this like ancient Greek tutelage that was happening. I don't think that the rent boys viewed it that way, because okay, they came into the courtroom on this libel case, and they all testified, yes, Oscar Wilde, maybe do this. And then he lost that libel suit. And then following that libel suit, that's when he went on trial for a criminal charge. The first case he won, he was found not guilty. But then he had a period of time in which he could leave the country. He didn't have enough money to leave the country. In the documentary, they make this claim that he stood his ground and was going to be an openly proud gay man. No, if he had the money to leave, he would have fucking done it. And then they had a second trial, and then he ended up being convicted not for a sodomy offense, but for a gross indecency offense.
So what you're saying is the documentary series took a few liberties to favor their narrative.
That was all because I think that they wanted to do the thing where Oscar Wilde is this very simple gay hero, this you know, guy persecuted for his sexuality, who fought it and stood up to everything. When in reality, like, he was a complex person, probably wasn't very nice to these rent boys, was the very reason that the police were drawn to his attention in the first place, because he was very concerned with, like, public image. Like, that was a very Oscar Wilde thing. It's like, his image was, like, everything. And that's how that proceeding followed. But, like, that story is too nuanced, I think, for what these people in the documentary actually want to convey. Anyway, that's my main two rants that I needed to get out.
Well, I've let you get them out, Jared. And I can't pretend to be an expert on the Oscar Wilde trial.
Yeah.
But I can definitely tell that a lot of things that are said in this series are skewed to, like, fit a certain narrative. And a lot of them are very speculative.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just kind of... It's really cool to see all of these queer icons and up-and-coming stars, etc., in this documentary.
Why is all of the cast of Yellow Jackets in it?
Well, two of the women in Yellow Jackets, like, play queer characters. I think they're also, like, lesbian or bisexual in real life.
Yeah, okay, Tawny Cypress, I looked up, and has been married to men for the last 30 years. Yeah, doesn't mean she's not queer. I know. Yeah, we're not supposed to say that. Blah, blah, blah.
But yeah, they obviously like Yellow Jackets. So, like, we need a contemporary, we need it now.
Oh, I think the reason the first episode pissed me off so much is because that was... because that's not even... The film directors aren't necessarily experts in that topic. Like, I mean, some of them have adapted... someone had adapted Dracula when they were talking about Bram Stoker and things like that. But, like, why would we expect these media figures to be the main experts for, like, titans of literature?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to go back to my criticism that I feel like it's presented like they're experts and they're really just people like us who are...
Yeah.
You know, like, I just think it's taking itself really seriously.
Yeah.
And it feels like a Year 11 media class.
Yes, like people are, absolutely.
People are finding meaning and deciding
people
it's
are having a go.
The thing is, you can theorize about these films, and a lot of the theories probably have some truth to them, but people are saying it like this is what the director was thinking. So it's like, at the time, you couldn't even openly talk about homosexuality, so we don't know what the directors were thinking.
No, but, like, there is historical record. Like, as in, that idea of that Oscar... Like, the idea that Oscar Wilde wouldn't have been overly troubled that he couldn't come out to his wife is a historical fact. Like, you can't project that modern anxiety back on someone at that time.
Yes, well, that's true. I mean, at that time, no one could have come out, really.
So, like, it's not... So this is what it's so infuriating, that, like, people feel very confident to then project that onto things that they've made, which is very, very odd. I don't know very much about Bram Stoker, so I don't know that bit about Bram Stoker, whether or not that accurate is.
I'll say in Bram Stoker's writing, there's obviously an affection for the male form, but then once again, it doesn't mean that he was secretly gay.
Yeah.
It could just mean, and sometimes as well, when you're writing something, like, as a low scale writer, I will write things for, like, the audience, from the perspective of the audience that I'm trying to capture as well.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that I, like, think or agree with what I'm writing all the time. It might just mean that, like, someone's like, I want this written for, like, a 14-year-old girl. So I'm going to try go from that perspective. And maybe he was trying to, I don't know. I think when you capture something erotic, you can still find, like, I could write, like, about a woman with, like, beautiful mounds of breasts or something. And I'm just, like, trying
to... That was the least convincing.
That was not sexy. But, you know, I could write an erotic story.
Beautiful mounds.
I could write a story about a woman and describe it as attractive.
Yeah.
Which is basically what he's done with Dracula. because the whole point of the character is meant to be that it has this allure to the other characters. So of course you need to, you need to convey that to the reader. So just saying that he's like a hot man doesn't necessarily mean in a more articulate way, but saying that someone's beautiful and is a man doesn't necessarily mean that you're like, I like men.
Well, like the thing is like that anxiety of men describing the beauty of other men or men not expressing their affection for other men is a modern anxiety. Like, as in, the gays kind of ruined it a little bit because, like, if you literally had no register for the threat of homosexuality in your head, you could, like, so that, I think with Bram Stoker, they also pinpointed like a letter to a friend as being indicative of him being gay. But like, again, you could say that, like, no, it was a letter to Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman did fuck men. But the idea of just expressing these genuine emotions between straight men, what we would call straight men, was common.
Hmm.
And it just, it just seems really simplistic to then just be like, you know, gay.
I guess Dracula and vampire, like, films, literature in general are, I guess, they do have, like, homoerotic under and occasionally overtones.
They, I mean, they do have sexual, yes.
But I think it's because, yeah, like, well, I was just gonna say that, it's because there's something very sexual about the whole, like, bloodletting and exchanging of, like, fluids.
Yeah.
And then often then that does tie into, like, homosexuality, usually lesbianism in vampire films.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of, like, forbidden, but, like, sexy, but wrong, but, like, right, you know. And so, I mean, you can definitely make some links between vampirism and homosexuality, but is that just the way that the genre evolved? Is it necessarily what Bram Stoker was going for?
I think in episode 3 they talk about it a little bit. But like, so there is a certain point in which everything becomes kind of self-awarely homoerotic. So like, actually no, they don't talk about her, which was fucking weird. Like Anne Rice has deliberately wrote the Vampire Chronicles to be homoerotic. Like, that was her intention from the start. Like, you can never deny that was the purpose that she was trying to do.
But also those books are contemporary-ish.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Well, that's what I mean, though. Like, are we maybe slightly projecting backwards in that, like, at this stage, vampirism has been so homoeroticized that when we then look back that we can't help but view those things in that way?
Yeah, it's interesting because this documentary also shows that clip from Hexan where everyone's sniffing the demon's like butthole.
Yeah.
And they're like, see, we've always had sexual taboos in horror films. And it's like, we don't know if that was just like for laughs or if like, I don't know,
perversion has always been a thing.
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily like, this is taboo and everyone's like sniffing his butthole. I don't know, you know, I think sometimes like what you said, we have attach contemporary meanings to things
in the past, that's a bad way of interpreting
and
media.
Cliches have evolved from all these films, and the associations have evolved from these films. That these films were like the OGs, so I don't know if like they were intended originally. Like the self awareness hadn't really come yet. Although it's interesting if they talk about James Whale.
Well, I was going to say episode 2 covers James Whale.
You really like James Whale, so you're going to be really pissed off here, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Okay. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say it talked about how he was quite self aware. Very early on, like, his films demonstrated a self-awareness of, like, horror tropes and the absurdity of these situations.
So he was, I think that they misinterpret him in a number of ways, some in, like, quite shocking ways. One, so James Whale, he is, when you think of the Universal Monsters, you think of James Whale. James Whale was a filmmaker responsible for Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, The Invisible Man, and there's a fourth one that I always forget the name of.
The Old Dark House.
Yes. So those kind of four huge horror films. The documentary series makes the common mistake of thinking that James Whale was in some way attracted to the horror genre, and he absolutely wasn't. So, like, he was essentially just like a workhorse for Hollywood. He didn't want to do so. There's a moment of the documentary, and they said, "Well, of course, when he finally went into filmmaking, he chose to do Frankenstein." James Whale did not choose to do Frankenstein. A studio said, "Oh, we have this, do this," because he was just a workhorse, and like he had this very very distinct style. He was very into German expressionism, and he brought that over to the United States, and that's who we have. Like that whole literally the classic horror media look, that like gothic type of horror media look, that is all because of James Whale. And James Whale was an openly gay man. And I say that in the biggest, like, people are often shocked by this idea. In the 1930s, everyone knew that he was gay.
Yeah.
He openly lived with his partner. He was known as kind of being a really queeny gay man. What I think they get wrong in the documentary is they tend to view that as like a really tortured experience, which it apparently wasn't. And I know people struggle to think about things this way. But there's a autobiography on James Whale by a guy named James Curtis. It's called Gods and Monsters. And it comes from interviews that James Curtis did with James Whale's life partner, whose name I cannot remember. But so this is like really firsthand details. And it describes the fact that in 1930s Hollywood, in this weird cultural enclave, nobody cared. Like, he literally could live as an openly gay man in these films and was widely praised. What they do in this documentary, which I think is actually like very, very offensive, is that they read into him choosing, well, him being allocated these horror films and say, well, clearly these are subtexts for being gay. And I have one particularly idiotic interpretation of this. This is from the director, Andrew Fleming. He says, this is in relation to Frankenstein's monster. He's a monster, and you know, just on the most basic level, gay people are called monsters. That is the level of fucking criticism that he's dealing with. According to James Curtis, the autobiography of James Whale, the monsters depicted in the Universal Monsters films were never meant to represent tortured homosexuality. And of course, none of that would make sense because James Whale was not a tortured homosexual.
Yeah, well, I think this is another case of people attaching their own meanings to... I mean, I did almost laugh when they were talking about The Bride of Frankenstein, and they're like... And Heaven Matarazzo, who's like a lesbian, was like...
I was like, say no? Is that
was like, when she said no, I felt like I could say no.
Which... It's weird. It's
like, that's a bit of a... Isn't that a reach? Like, you're... What, this film made you realise that you were allowed to be a lesbian?
Yeah. And, like, from what I was, James Whale was not, like, a feminist.
I think it is a component of probably James Whale growing up and having some sort of outsider status that is projected in these films. But isn't Maybe. Necessarily about being homosexual. And I think with the old Dark House, too, I think a lot of people were like, it was like all these, like, queer actors, like, coming together. Yeah. And I feel like it was probably just because he was in, like, you know, like you were saying, it wasn't like, it was kind of just like a known secret in the 1930s. There are a lot of gay actors.
Yeah.
So it was probably just him and all of his friends making a movie together. I don't know if there was like a deeper.
No, I don't think either. I don't think, again, it's this urge that people have to read in stuff.
Hmm.
When if you like, I don't know, maybe I'm too limited in my thinking, but I like to think about like, what did the director and the filmmaker actually want from this? I don't see any benefit of me making shit up, you know?
But I think this is something as well, though, because modern horror now always has to be elevated. Basically, to be a critically acclaimed film, there needs to be like...
There needs to be a message.
There needs to be subtext that's relevant to contemporary society, right?
Yeah.
And I don't feel like that was the case until the last 10 years, even less.
Mm.
And so I feel like... Like a lot of 90s horror films, like they were made to be scary. There was no subtext. There was not like, it's like this film is about class disparity. No, it was just about a monster that was killing people in an apartment complex. It's not necessarily saying anything deeper than that. And I feel like these films, it literally was the studio were like, we want something that's going to thrill audiences and that will scare them.
Yeah. And like they were kind of, so I think the main thing that like, clearly, James Whale is a very talented person. I think there is an interesting story to be told about this openly gay man who made these sorts of things. But I think his real fucking talent was taking things which I think they were designed to be these like popcorn films. And then because he was this very... So there's all this stuff in this autobiography. He grew up in like a working class family, but he very much wanted to be part of like almost like the aristocracy. Like he had a very pretentious view of the world. And so I you can see that in his films that he was given these like this crappy schlock and he was like, I'm going to imbue that with German expression. You know what I mean? Like that's clearly a, he artsied up what otherwise would have been trashy, pulpy, you know, particularly because like science fiction-y things were associated with those like, with like magazines for kids and stuff. And so like that's his real talent. And wouldn't it have been great if in this documentary series that they like appreciated the actual man and not like...
Yeah, I think it's a lot of the things are really reaching. I think when they started talking about Hitchcock, I think Hitchcock had overt homosexual themes in his films. And you can definitely make reads on that because it's obvious that's what he was trying to do.
And I will say on that, I think they did make the great call. I can't remember which interviewer said it, but they did note the fact that like Hitchcock was fascinated by homosexuality, but mainly from the perspective that it was kind of like...
taboo.
Deviant. Yeah. Like we looked at Rope and stuff. Like clearly that has homosexual themes. And it's based on a real life. But like I think he was fascinated by... the almost like the rebelliousness of it.
Yeah.
The underworlds of homosexuality.
I mean, even Rebecca, it's kind of like a psychosexual lesbian kind of thriller, you know? It's like, so he's kind of fascinated by that sort of...
He wasn't a hashtag ally. He was more of a,
Yeah. I mean, maybe to an extent. I guess it's like, it was still some of the earliest, like, overt homosexual subtext that was probably on film. So in some ways, he was still bringing it to the forefront.
I think because it was a provocateur. But was like, a provocateur is going to be interested in you.
Was it advancing the gay movement or the queer movement? Probably not.
No.
But
was it in this one as well that we got that? Okay, this is the one touching part of this series is Oz Perkins, who is a filmmaker who made Black Coat's Daughter.
Yes.
His father is Anthony Perkins.
Yeah.
And he told that really, really wonderful story about his father dying of AIDS and how, like, the family had to lie about it.
Say it was from a blood transfusion.
Like, that to me was, like, a really touching, great moment just out of nowhere in this series. And then, like, there was that little segment and then it went on.
But it was interesting, though, because he was also talking about the undertones in, like, interviews and media about Anthony Perkins, implying he was, like, effeminate or... and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And how they kind of, even in his death, had to kind of plug that and be like, he was a devoted husband to a wife. And, you know.
And like, and I thought that was a fair, so no, I don't hate, I've been ranting about these couple of things that just particularly pissed me off. Like there are some good-ish bits. I think if like a better person in charge of this series, was in charge, there would probably be, it could be that there are, because I'm assuming they just do full interviews with everyone, right? There's probably a good film in there. If you just went back to good series in there, where you go back to the interviews and like actually tease out the interesting stuff.
Well, I just think I'm more interested to see if as the series progresses, we don't know how many episodes it has. I think
Only four. Okay. So we haven't been able to see the fourth episode.
Yeah.
The third episode, I actually have no comments on. It's about werewolves, mostly, which, again, I think werewolves have always symbolized sexuality, so I don't think anyone's reading anything that into that. Also, modern, like, they were referencing, like, ginger snaps and stuff. Yeah. Like, clearly that's on purpose.
Yeah, well, that's... Last thing, I think this series probably would bode better if they looked at things that were a bit more contemporary and actually unpacked things like ginger snaps, so there's clear intended meaning that's kind of informed by, like, decades of cinema and social evolution, whereas I feel like the fact that it focuses primarily on the 1920s to 1940s, and it's very speculative, I guess that's what's a bit frustrating about it. And I think it's the way it's presented too factual, when it should just be more casual. Like,
do you know what? Like, also just asking the right interviewee the right question. So, like, Alaska Thunderfuck, who I'm not, you know, I vaguely know who she is in terms of a drag queen, but if you asked her about like Ed Wood and like those kind of B horror films, clearly her look is entirely based off of those movies.
Yeah.
Like she would probably have really good perspectives on that. I don't know why we're asking her about Mary Shelley.
I mean, I did learn from Alaska Thunderfuck that allegedly Mary Shelley lost her virginity on her. her mum's gravestone, or was it her dad's grave? Her mum's gravestone.
Oh, that sounds like completely apocryphal. I don't know if that's true.
Well, that was in the documentary. I was like, oh, that's an interesting, that's a nice intergenerational
coming
of age, so to speak, in many senses.
The but comment about her being a hag who loved her gaze just got me. That was so bad.
Yeah, I think once again, if I had just been like, there's a chance that like, well, like, wouldn't that have been funny if? I think it's just because everything is spoken as fact. It's like you, and it's just like, we don't know.
But like, again, maybe I'm being too academic about it, but like, so Mary Shelley was part of the romanticist movement. Okay, so romanticism was like in a rebellion to enlightenment. You can do a direct line from the romanticism movement to gay liberation movements, because they were tied together. They were all about rebelling against this,
like sexual and monogamy norms.
Yeah, yeah. Or like nudism, and like there is definitely a connection intellectually between the two, but they don't want to do that. They want to do this simple, like, she had the same experience as me way of doing it.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess it's just to create a more succinct, like, narrative in a documentary, but yeah, comes across a bit like presumptuous and know-it-all, but like not in an authentic or believable way.
I wanted to finish off talking about, and finishing off our last episode, by just talking about all the movies that they didn't cover, that they could have covered, because they were covered by the Sinister Sissies podcast.
That's true. Where was Cruising?
Well, okay, yeah, so, okay, some of these clearly were a bit too obscure. So, like, Otto or Up With Dead People, the Bruce LaBruce film. Although, having Bruce LaBruce as an interviewee would have made sense. He's, like, one of the, like, most well-known gay horror filmmakers. Nightmare on Elm Street 2, no mention.
Yeah, that was weird, because that's, like, and that's an interesting one, because remember how the director was like, I never intended for that film to be gay. And I think now he's changed his tune, right? But, like, Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker,
yep.
/ Night Warning, whatever title. Yeah, Sleepaway Camp. There are so many films that just like...
Sleepaway Camp. Maybe Sleepaway Camp's too problematic. Kenneth Anger, the films of Kenneth Anger maybe is too artsy.
Maybe that's too obscure. But like if something's problematic though, it can be unpacked really well. Yeah. So why like... But I guess this documentary series was meant to be covering the origins of horror. I guess that's, but then they keep showing contemporary clips, so this is all a bit confusing.
I would have trust these sets of interviewees to have really good opinions on Dante's Cove.
That's true. And, oh, I have all these flashbacks now to films that we've done.
Should we read them all? Okay, these are the films that we've done. Oh, I can't do the serial killers as well, but like, okay. When did you come in? Hellbent was the first film that we did together, Sam.
I believe so, yeah.
Butcher Baker, Nightmare Waker. Sleepaway Camp. Remember we did a audio commentary for the Patreon for the sequel.
I feel like that probably wasn't great, and I'm never going to listen to that.
Invocation of My Demon Brother. Knife Plus Heart.
Classic. I actually watched Invocation of My Demon Brother, I think, when I was high on acid. I mean...
The Kenneth Anger. Yeah.
No, I wasn't. No, I didn't.
The Fourth Man. Spiral, which was that...
Yeah, Spiral you hated.
That was a bit of a mutter on. Fear No Evil, that was kind of fun.
Oh, and I think I watched that on Halloween one year.
Irreversible, classic. In a Glass Cage, that disturbing.
Film, yeah, that's...
That's a Dharma.
I'm getting a bad taste in my mouth just thinking about that film.
Good film, though. Good film. Stranger by the Lake, Killer Condom, Midnight Kiss. Oh, that was the terrible fucking... what?
That was part of that series.
Hulu?
No. Yeah, it was the Hulu series where every month they had a different horror film that was themed after an event that month. That month was New Year's.
The Covenant, which you did by yourself. Muscle, which is that Japanese film, which is like it stood up. This is where we had Luke on. We did Gayracula. Dante's Cove. We had Luke on for that as well. King Cobra. My Friend Dharma.
Which was sort of like referenced a little bit in, not referenced, but we saw some glimmers of the events of My Friend Dharma in the Dharma series.
They almost did like a little mini version.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Well, they even had him going into the yearbook photos.
They did
and
him
stuff.
Spazzing out. Yeah. Yeah. That's our previous episode. So that's you can tell we're doing this back to back. Cut Snake and Downriver.
Look, I wouldn't expect the latter two to be mentioned in this documentary, but yeah, we've covered a lot of stuff over the years.
I'm proud of what I've done, and I'm so happy to have had you on for the last couple of years.
Well, I'm happy to. Sissies. I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah.
I was happy to have been here because it's about to be a past tense. But
it is. We've covered many a killer and many a homoerotic horror. So Sam will not be gone forever. He will be continuing with his own podcast. Stay tuned on our socials. Is that the best way?
I will definitely direct people via those into what I'm gonna do.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, but I just want to thank everyone, especially during the Halloween months and past years. You know, we've had so many good talks about film and serial killers and just fun. Like the feedback, and you know, those few people that, you know, always send us messages.
Some of the creepy ones.
Well, I'm thanking anyone and everyone because you've left an impression, whether it be mildly unsettling or, you know, heartwarming. It's still been, you know,
it's good to know that people are listening.
It's still been an iconic speck on the Sinister Sissies map.
Well, why don't I, for the very last time...
I've never seen Jared upset before. He actually looks emotional.
For the very last time, you can, well... Follow us at Sinister Sissies to see what Sam is up to next, or at
Sinister _ Sissies on Instagram.
On our Instagram. For the very last time, though, we're going to do it together.
Well, I just want to say a big thank you to you as well, Jared.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm glad that I've got a sinister comrade from this. I still remember after the first time we met, and now here we are.
Yeah.
Because we only met. Met because of the podcast, Jared. It was like a job interview.
Yeah.
So you know, here I am on the couch of my boss, drunk. Like, I don't know where we're going. This is... Okay. I'm going to stop talking.
He needs to move on.
As per usual, I put my foot in my mouth and make some like dark connotation that isn't there. I'm very happily on the couch with Jared.
Let's end it
together. His hands on my leg.
Let's end it together.
Okay.
Until next time, though.
Stay sinister.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.